You're listening to The Mumcast, the best weekly comic book podcast recorded in Southampton, England on Thursday nights. In our 164th episode, we talk about this week's comics, and in this week's spotlight, James talks about Asterix and the Chieftain's Shield. Aaron, what's my car?
Hello, I'm James.
Hello, I'm Nick.
Hello, I'm James.
She got it right, that's her name, James.
She nailed it. Oh, hello.
Jane knows her name, it's awesome. How have you two been? What have you been up to this week? Anything good?
I've had the rest of my holiday, which was lovely, and then had to do that some work, which wasn't so much.
How's that working out for you?
I was in this weird holiday bubble for Monday. I was pretty incoherent for most of the day. Tuesday, I was a bit like, oh, I should really get back into doing things. Lunchtime yesterday, I was all back to business, really. And today, I'm just like, oh, why did I come back from holiday?
So it sounds like a roller coaster. It's like, I keep forgetting that Southampton's the home of, like, sounding out exactly what you did in a week since Craig David did it in that song.
Yeah. It's because I put lip balm on, I can't resist it.
That noise is awesome. This is Liquid Radio.
Nice. Quite like that. That's very good, Jane, thank you.
Thanks.
If you could just stop it.
So we're underwater, it's amazing, and there are fish all around.
Nice.
Now it's me.
We should do this for an hour and a half.
And I watched Iron Man 2 at the weekend, and I really like Scarlett Johansson in the film, but I don't really understand why she's in the film. And she could have, I wanted her to have a film with her own.
There is a weird, the whole thing with her, and then with the man who made the film, who is in it. There's a weird scene at the end where they're storming a place together.
Yes.
And you get the feeling that he's got some motivation in that final scene that you haven't really had it explained to you. Because it's like he's trying to prove something, but you're not. It's very weird. It's
is
very
that John Favreau as Foggy Nelson?
John Faschini, yes.
John Faschini.
Not as Foggy Nelson. It's as Happy Hogan. That's his name, Happy Hogan.
But Hulk Hogan, played by Justin Faschini.
But to compare to that, I also watched Coneheads at the weekend. Because when that came out of the cinema, I really, really wanted to go and see it. I must have been about 8 years old, and I wasn't old enough to go and see it, or my mum wouldn't take me or something. And I got to watch that the weekend, and it was really weird and silly and good and funny. Do you try and remember?
I watched it a fortnight ago.
Did you? Mm-hmm. It was on Netflix. Did you like it, or...?
I liked it as much as I liked it when I first saw it.
Oh, you saw
it? Around about 93, 94 when it came out.
I had not seen it.
It's funny. It's not Dan Aykroyd's best one.
No, God no. It's a kid's film.
Is the theme tune by They Might Be Giants or someone like that? I'm going to have to look that up.
Oh, Jeebus, I don't know that.
I'm going to have to look that up.
Is everything by They Might Be Giants? Or
at some point, yes.
There's a lot of They Might Be Giants obsession going on in our flat at the moment. It's weird. Mostly mine. I'm trying to wean myself off them. That and Captain Bog and Salty, and I can't.
That doesn't even sound like a real thing. Oh, that sounds like a thing you just made up.
I can't get the song. There's a song with Captain Bog and Salty called Don't Drink Seawater, which I can't get out of my head.
So that was fun. And I finished season 4 of Breaking Bad.
How did you feel after you finished?
Oh, I really want to have babies with that show.
Oh, okay.
That's... Do you want to carry the babies or do you want to impregnate it with the babies?
I want to impregnate it with the babies.
Good.
Okay.
Just try and imagine how that would work.
We should have like a little minute to think about what that might look like.
I don't think we need to. Bare Naked Ladies are on it, who are another favourite of mine, not They Might Be Giants.
Yeah. And they're pretty much the same band, aren't they?
They're hardly not at all. What are you talking about? The only thing that the Bare Naked Ladies caused me problems with is that because of them, I always get this really optimistic feeling, quite despite myself, whenever the Big Bang Theory starts.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really like the theme tune to the Big Bang Theory, which is by the Bare Naked Ladies. But then the theme tune finishes, and it's just the Big Bang
Theory. And then it starts, yeah.
One of our colleagues was speculating on why I don't like the Big Bang Theory this week. Could have, yeah, not agreed even in the slightest. But
have you forgotten our words?
I just want to push people over mood, and yeah. I was like, no, it wouldn't be fair to push her over. I strongly disagreed, but played along because that's what you do.
I think the Big Bang Theory is one of those strange shows that I was happy to just not like it when it came out, but the more people I know who seem to really like it, and I'm surprised that they really like it, the more confused I get, and that confusion comes out as anger. And it shouldn't really, it should just come out as confusion, but
I'm finding my attitude of ambivalence towards it quite easy to maintain.
I think that one thing the Big Bang Theory has going for it is that none of the people involved with it have come out and turned around and said how much they hate it and how evil and satanic it is. So that's a step in the right direction. And then
24 hours later,
recanted.
Remember how much you get paid per episode and realise that, you know, you better hedge your bets if you're onto an earner, because God might not be real, so best make a lot of money.
So that was your week then, Jane. How was it? It was good. You're okay. You're happy with it. It's not too bad. You'd rather still be on holiday.
Yes.
Okay. I understand that. James, what about you?
I watched the Avengers.
Oh, was it your first time?
My first time, yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes, good.
Did all the characters make sense?
Well, they spoke English and I could understand.
Did you understand why they're in the film?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I agree with Kevin Smith that the premise is a little bit thin. But it's enjoyable nonetheless.
My favourite thing is that, like, beams of light keep going up from things in New York and making portals in the air. Yeah, it's one of my favourite things about New York.
My absolute favourite thing is, I agree with people who said they love the Hulk.
Talk about New York. Did you hear that on this Monday, just gone, 24 hours of no violent crimes reported? Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Although what it suggests to me is that people just weren't reporting all of the violent crimes that
were
happening.
Well, that's...
Or the police took the phone off the hook.
Yeah.
No violent crime at all! Click.
But maybe all of the non-violent crimes went up. I don't know. Do we know? That's pretty cool, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're making light of it because it completely offends our view of the way the world works. It freaks us out. Cats and dogs living together. Real biblical end of the world shit.
Oh, fuck it, all the Mayans and all that. Yeah, I liked it. I very much enjoyed my two favourite moments in the film were both featuring the Hulk, and I imagine if you've watched it, you know what the two best Hulk bits
were. They God related?
Both were God related.
Yes.
Alright. I'll wait until the two God related bits towards the end of the movie. They are delightful.
Not towards the end, they're just in the movie.
Yeah. Especially the second one of the two, which made me laugh out loud.
Yes. Did you LOL?
I did. And the helicopter.
Did you ROFL?
No, I didn't, because I'd never get back up again. The helicarrier is very cool.
I like the helicarrier, but seeing it in a film suddenly makes you realise how very unlikely and impractical it probably is.
Well, I have to say, I thought they look cooler in Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
Are you feeling a bit bilious?
I'm not feeling at all well. That's the other thing I'm doing my week, is not managing my stress very well.
Oh.
I'm quite stressed out of work. I'm really not managing it very well at all. Which is not good. So there's still another day to go in the week. So every chance I'm going to go post it before the end of the week, which is something to look forward to.
Yay.
Isn't it?
That'll buy some my Friday night.
Yeah. Almost went postal yesterday, actually, but that's neither here nor there.
The good thing about going postal, if A, you're an average British office worker, and B, you're you, or say me, is that in a general sense you're so ineffectual and impotent in general that going postal normally just means pressing your mouse key a bit harder for a couple of hours rather than getting a gun and going through the office.
I think if I went properly postal, I'd probably just start handing out letters.
Yeah, really passive-aggressive emails.
There you go.
Firing off passive-aggressive emails. Actually, in that sense, I've probably gone postal several times at work. some mornings it'll just be like, wow, I just sent 5 passive aggressive emails.
I also, tragically, I've come to the end of the US Office on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
and I'm scrabbling around to find the new American sitcom.
That explains it.
So I've had a little go with The League, which you've indicated I might want to stick with and give another go.
No, that is not what I said.
Well, no, from what you said, it has indicated. I don't think you intended to indicate that to me.
Oh.
But what you said has inadvertently indicated to me that maybe I want to give it another go.
I do not think the jokes are necessarily there, and that's a real sign of a properly good sitcom.
Mm.
But I think that what I actually said was, before the show, if anything's even halfway decently made, if you watch it for more than 3 or 4 episodes, you start to care enough about the characters, even if you don't like them very much, that you kind of want to spend another 20 minutes with them and another 20 minutes with them and another 20 minutes with them.
Which is what I found with the other sitcom I started with, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They're entirely loathsome.
Mm.
But I really enjoyed watching the loathsome people be loathsome.
I think you should say what you accidentally called it earlier on, because that's a pretty good review of it.
It's Always Funny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I thought that was cute.
It is quite funny.
Have you not watched Children's Hospital and Community yet, though?
No.
In 7 years' time.
Yeah, in 7 years' time. They're not quite outdated.
No, that's not fair. I want you to watch them.
If he's not on Netflix.
One thing that Children's Hospital has that doesn't fit in. See, I think a sitcom should have the jokes. And I freely admit there are lots of shows I like, lots of sitcoms I like that don't have the jokes, but I have come to like the characters through sheer dogged persistence. Okay. That aren't necessarily good programs. There's a whole wave of sitcoms following Friends, which I did actually quite like. There has been a whole wave of sitcoms that think that the real winning formula for Friends that they should repeat was annoying middle class hipster people walking into rooms, shouting their intentions, and then responding by shouting their so lots of people walking into rooms basically shouting their lines at each other with a slight Chandler edge, and that's funny. And I don't really agree with that, but I think Children's Hospital has the jokes. I think it has the jokes in abundance. It doesn't really. The characters are demented, though. There's no consistency to them from one week to the next. So
isn't it funny? Because you say I thought It's Always Funny in Philadelphia was like hipster Cheers.
Did you? That probably is a bit. I think hipster is one of those words like geek that we kind of know what it means.
Yeah.
But it's really difficult to explain. Like bilious, I looked up bilious the other day. I've been using it a lot for the last few weeks because I've been feeling a bit bilious after most meals and stuff. And I looked it up, and it doesn't mean even. It doesn't seem to mean even remotely what.
A bit sicky.
Well, that's what I think it means. A bit sicky, maybe a bit windy, but all over the place. Yeah. Not to the extent that it feels like wind that you can identify as wind. You don't really feel sick. But you feel a bit sick.
What does it mean?
You don't really feel windy. It just kind of means of vile intent or something like that. It's weird.
Really?
Yeah, there's 2 or 3 definitions of it.
No, but I've definitely heard it in the context that I use it.
Yeah, I think probably me.
No, other people. Oh, I feel a bit bilious.
So you've been feeling a bit bilious?
All the fucking time.
That's been your week.
Avengers
and bilious.
Hold on. Poor stress management.
Avengers, poor stress management, bilious.
Yes, that's it.
Okay. I have been looking up bilious.
Brilliant. How that
works. That's pretty much what I've been doing. Well, it didn't mean what I thought it meant. Oh. I'm going to keep using it, though. It's fine.
You learned something new, then.
Oh, and also I got disproportionately annoyed earlier on that my people, which are podcasters, weren't represented in the British Comic Awards. But that's all we have to say about that. Narcissistic personality disorder.
Hello.
I've just named that. I don't even know if that's a real thing. I'm sure one of our listeners will tell us.
Or James, for short.
When we're not making up diagnoses and waiting for one of our friend listeners to correct us on it, you know who you are. We... we sometimes talk about comics. You can email us to talk to us about comics, or ask us questions about the show or about comics, or send us a contribution for the show. And you can email us at
moncast@gmail.com.
I realise I've led myself into talking about the Twitter accounts, James. That's what happened
there.
It was
possibly my favourite sentence I've ever heard out loud.
Otherwise, and possibly easier, you can talk to us on Twitter. Jane's on Twitter at...
JaneMom.
James is on Twitter at...
JamesMom.
And I'm on Twitter at NickSite. We're also on Facebook and Tumblr and Google+. You can see links to those at our website. Our website is...
MomComics.com.
And that's where you can find old episodes of the show as well. There have been 163 plus a whole bunch of specials and stuff, which are awesome. I just got a real urge to just slap it in my face.
It happens. It's fine. You learn to deal with it. You sort of have to look at him and just imagine a really vulnerable puppy, and then you don't want to hurt him anymore. Look, like the look he's doing now. Sorry, listener, you can't see it. He's doing vulnerable puppy look.
You can. I remembered what I was going to say. You can subscribe to us on anything that you can subscribe to podcasts on. The most popular of those things is iTunes. But if you do like us at all, you can review us on most of the different podcatchery things we use. And if you did that, that'd be nice, because it'd be nice for us to know that you like what we do or hate what we do. Actually, that would be quite nice as well. It'd fit right into mine and James's worldviews.
Yeah.
Mike draws, bouncing here and there and everywhere. High adventures that beyond compare. He is Mike draws. Hi, this is Michael George, you here, who draws a lot. Hello, nice to meet you. I am here for a very quickie just to say that on December, the 1st of December, that's this Saturday, have a look at the Mighty Jambo. If you're wondering why I am advertising the Mighty Jambo, it's because George Beedham's very busy at the moment drawing. Because if you remember, I think it was last year, he did a daily Christmas comic for the 24 Days of Christmas. And yeah, he's doing it again this year, but the big difference is that the story is written by me. So yes, pop on over to the Mighty Jambo website this Saturday and you'll see the first page of the comic, which I'm very excited about, because what I've written and what he's drawn is just completely different. So I'm quite excited to see how it turns out. Yeah, so what to expect? There's going to be several new characters. There's going to be a lot of fighting. Oh my god, there's action-packed, punch in face, smash, crash, brilliant. There's going to be a lot of drama, laughs and tears. So go on, get onto the Mighty Jambo website. I'll bully Nick to put a link on the website. And if there isn't a link there, just Google the Mighty Jambo. It's the first thing there. And, you know, why not, in the comments section, why not just say, George, this page is lovely, release more, you git. Anyway, that's it for this week. Oh, God, it's locked again. You know, every time I do this, the phone locks, and then I can never stop it. Okay, right, here we go. That's the end of the contribution. Thank you, love you, bye, bye.
James, you have to talk about your comics.
Do you know, I've gone first, I think, so like 3 weeks in a row.
But you're doing the spotlight.
No, it's not fair. Jane bullied me into it last week.
Oh, okay, Jane, you have
no,
to...
No, it's all right, I'll go first. It's fine.
You're such a whinger.
Yeah. The first book that I would like to talk to you about today, listener, and Jane and Nick, is a number one. It's a Dynamite book by Chris Robinson.
Chris Robinson. You'll know Chris Robinson as the man who said he wasn't going to be working for DC anymore on... work for higher jobs, yes. But that's besides the point.
Okay, shall I'll just do a second take?
Well, no, I mean, it's fine. I've said the name for you because you apparently couldn't.
Chris Robinson.
That's better.
And Alex Ross.
That's his name, no, you got it right.
And, fine. I was just pausing so Nick, just so Nick could agree with me.
I thought Nick was going to give a fun fact about Alex Ross.
Yeah, go on.
He's 7 foot tall, but tends to wear heels, which make him appear to be 7 foot five.
He's, yeah. And also he has one mutated finger.
Why did you just look at your balls?
Because they vibrated.
And they're lit up at the moment.
My wife's being lovely at the moment. She sent me a really nice text a moment ago, and I responded to it, and she's responding to that.
Oh, okay.
And he's got a... Yeah, I was going to, go on a thing about him having a long finger that he uses as a paintbrush, but I don't... That's not true. And it's not funny either, crushingly.
You managed to respond to and send a text... you managed to respond to a text from your wife without disrupting the show at all, but then talked about it.
Yeah.
About a minute and a half later or something.
I can't help myself. I'm compulsive like that. Masks is the first Dynamite sort of crossover with their classic heroes lineup. So you've got the Spider, the Shadow, Kato in the Green Hornet, and Cutlass Dude.
No, it can't be Zorro. Zorro.
Or Zorro. There's a giveaway.
Hence the big Z on the cover.
Yeah, I've always called him. Cutlass Dude. That's why I always think Batman's parents were shot after he'd gone to see Mark of Cutlass Dude.
It isn't even a cutlass.
It is a cutlass.
It's a rapier.
Oh, it's a...
Isn't a cutlass a curved sword?
No.
Oh, your
rapier.
Oh, God.
I thought you meant he cut people without cutting them. He's cutlass. I didn't realise it's a thing.
Who are you? Anyway, Masks is a team up.
Can I just clarify for the listener the comment James just made about me being rapier? It was just a play on the term, on the word rapier. Is not, neither of us are. We just aren't. It's not. We're not like that.
And it's not funny. Masks is, as you would expect, beautiful to behold because Alex Ross paints beautiful panels.
Yes.
Whether or not it works for you as a comic book panel is a matter for debate. Probably.
You sound like you have an opinion, though.
I do. I love looking at his art so much, but sometimes the action feels stilted and a little bit dead. I think because it's so perfect, it looks like snapshots.
It's so perfect, but there's very little motion in it.
That's it, yeah. So it is lovely. This book in particular concentrates on... the Shadow and Kato and the Green Hornet teaming up to deal with this shadowy villainous figure. To deal with this shadowy villainous political party that has kind of taken power in New York, and they're sort of rolling out these rather unpleasant fascist cops.
Stormtroopers.
Essentially. The Justice Party, they're called. And there's all sorts of political intrigue and machinations going on around that. But the Shadow, with his delightful nose, and the Green Hornet trying to get to the bottom of it. Read the first runs of both of those books, The Shadow, which I enjoyed until Garth Ennis left. Not that I didn't enjoy he took over, I just decided to jump off after Garth Ennis left. And I read the Smith run, Kevin Smith run of... Green Hornet. It's quite interesting to see them bring these characters together. Like I say, whether or not it works brilliantly as a comic book is a matter of some debate. It is strange. I found myself very detached from the action because of the quality of Ross's art, but I bought it for his art, which seems a bit hypocritical, but I love looking at it. Catcher 22.
It looks a little bit more dynamic than his art has done in the past. I do like his Shadow, but you get away with a lot with the Shadow because of the scarf and how much of a caricature he is.
He draws really characterful faces, but just there's a few of them that look a little bit dead as well. It's sort of in the eyes sometimes. And I think it's because it's like this sort of hyper-realist sort of finish. It's, I don't know, some pages work brilliantly, some don't. And I also feel like a massive arse criticising Alex Ross. Well, he's clearly,
I think it's a fair criticism. He's
that scene works very well, actually.
The one in the courtroom.
There's a courtroom scene that I think works brilliantly, strangely enough. But then there's a scene where the Shadow and the Green Hornet, their alter egos, their real life alter egos, meeting in a restaurant that didn't work for me at all. But
I am slightly perplexed by the fact that Zorro is in this. Is Zorro only in it referred to as a past thing? Because the times don't match up, do they?
No.
So it's a bit spurious having him.
Zorro doesn't appear in it at all.
Involved. Yeah. This is in a universe where there once was a guy called Zorro.
But very possibly he's not really referred to. So.
Yeah. There's a picture of him.
Yeah, I was terribly sleepy last night. You know, I didn't even read that picture of Zorro on such a thicky. I read it as the Lone Ranger.
But the Lone Ranger doesn't have a sword.
Yeah, I know.
A cutlass.
I was really tired last night. It's a rapier. I was really tired last night reading this, and I must admit, when I read that, I thought it was the Lone Ranger.
There are Alex Ross's art works when it comes to panels that could be covers. Or pages that could be covers. There's one really nice thing where the Shadow's jumping off the top of the building, and it's a nice. Yeah,
he's
I see what
you
mean.
He's using his nose to slide down.
Yeah.
He's got a really big nose, is what I'm saying.
But he does, though.
Yeah.
He has a big nose. He can't help it.
I didn't notice it. The other.
You wouldn't like it if we constantly, over like 163 episodes, pointed out your physical traits.
There is nothing about my body that you could criticise that I couldn't criticise more.
There's nothing about your body I could criticise. You're perfect.
Yeah!
You're a beautiful and unique snowflake.
I hope I'm unique. The second book that I'd like to talk about is one that I believe Nick picked up as well.
I picked it up, but we had different covers, so if we weren't really on the ball, we might have got confused.
Marvel Now!
That's going to be difficult.
Oh,
thanks,
sorry about your ears. That was really petulant. I'm sorry, ears.
You got the Mike Allred cover. I got the Scotty Young cover. The Scotty Young cover is very cute.
I don't really like the Mike Allred cover.
Yeah, it's all right.
Mike Allred also does the interiors of issue 1 of FF, written by Matt Fraction with colour by Laura Allred.
How did you get his surname right and then his wife's surname, which is exactly the same surname, completely wrong?
I called her Allred, didn't I?
Yes,
rather
you did.
Allred.
Yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed. Very pleased with that. It's the first issue of Matt Fraction's FF. Which certainly you could not criticise Michael Allred's characters of not acting and being dynamic, because they are in spades. It was really interesting reading these two back to back, because this felt really zippy and vibrant in comparison.
To Alex Ross's art.
You were doing a contrast,
you're doing thematic.
I am, yeah.
This is Liquid Podcaster.
And I love also Michael Allred mixes up his style really beautifully throughout the book. Each page pops, doesn't it? It's absolutely beautiful. This follows on from Fantastic Four from a couple of weeks ago, where Reed Richards has discovered that he's got a boo-boo and he needs to fix it.
A boo-boo?
Yeah, so he's taking the kids for a journey into time, space, and
imagination.
Come with me into a world beyond imagination.
Although it is one of the least scientific things I think he will ever do in however many decades of comics.
Yeah.
Because the reason he's doing it is I don't know if this counts as a spoiler for the first issue of Fantastic Four, but the reason he is taking them on this journey for a year is he's worked out that there isn't a solution for his boo-boo in reality.
Yeah.
There isn't a solution for it at all. In our universe at all. So there must be one in another universe somewhere. That's his reasoning. Yeah. That's his rationale. Yeah. So that's why he's taking his family.
Made perfect sense to me.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I like it.
But while they're gone, they're going to be gone for a year. But because they're going through different dimensions and universes, it will seem like they're only gone for 4 minutes.
Yes.
But because he's a bit narcissistic, and just in case something goes wrong, they want to ensure that there's a Fantastic Four left behind. This book deals with two things. It deals with getting the Fantastic Four team together, which will feature, you can see from the cover, She-Hulk, Ant-Man, that lady from the Inhumans.
Medusa. She's got the long hands.
Whose hair does brilliant things. And well, that's Ben Grimm, but who was the lady with...
It clearly isn't Ben Grimm, because it's got a lady's head.
No, but I forget her name.
I am not familiar with her, but she is a lady with... She's got a lady face.
Lady pink hair.
She's got a lady with pink hair face.
And she was sleeping with Johnny Storm.
But she's got Ben Grimm's body. But I don't think it's actually Ben Grimm's body. It's the Thing's body.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's confusing. But what's lovely is you have... Most of the way through the book, you have the kids from the Future Foundation doing pieces to camera, essentially, don't you?
Mm.
Explaining what the Future Foundation's all about and what they like about it and so forth. And then on the opposing page, you've got the getting the team together parts of the story. So the scenes chip along really quickly, don't they? So it's a really sort of really frenetic... Frenetic's not the right word, but the story really zips along at a lovely pace.
It's a lovely framing device, isn't it? The framing device is that one of the characters asks the different members, the different kids in the FF, Future Foundation, what it is. So it's quite a good introduction for someone who, because I am way behind on the Jonathan Hickman run, so. I'm way behind on the Jonathan Hickman run, so it was quite interesting for me having that little explanation, because it's moved along a little bit from where
I was. And I've been reading it, but then, you know, I read characters as the Lone Ranger when in fact they're Zorro. So.
I find it quite interesting. Michael Rood's art makes for some really nice, big, dynamic, detailed panels, but then the framing mechanism... It makes for some quite rigid. It's like almost straight to camera sequences, which really let the characters act, which is really nice. I do like
the opening scene between Franklin and Valeria. Oh god, it's just makes delightful. You squee, doesn't it?
Yes, I really liked this.
Mm.
I do wonder what the point of it. Is without you also reading Fantastic Four. That's the only thing about it. I think we
need to be reading both.
Obviously, it's only the first issue, so once the Fantastic Four are off and this team are on their own, maybe it'll have an identity of its own. But certainly this first issue is very much a companion piece for Fantastic Four number one.
Even during Jonathan Hickman's run, though, I wouldn't have wanted to read it. I can't imagine anyone reading FF without reading Fantastic Four. However, you can read Fantastic Four without really needing to read FF. But I kind of just see it a little bit like, it's kind of like Spider-Man publishes fortnightly.
Yeah.
For me, it just feels like Fantastic Four publishes fortnightly.
You already know you're going to buy them both anyway.
Yeah, which so. I'm absolutely fine with. I adored it.
It's lovely.
So lovely. Even I was so tired, I actually fell asleep. I was lying on my belly on the bed, propping... with my hand on my chin and actually fell asleep in that position before I got to the end of the book. I was really whacked.
That's age, though. It's starting to happen to me a little bit as well. Shall I... No, that's cool. Shall I carry on because I was talking a little bit about that, or do you want to talk about your book?
I don't think you can. I was just going to say thank you to James.
Thank you, Jane.
Yeah. Thanks, James.
It's all right.
Godzilla number 7, Straczynski and Simon Gain, it continues to be marvellous. The only reason I'm really mentioning it this issue, though, is that Simon Gain is back on it. I don't know if you remember, but the last issue had a fill-in artist that was very nice, but I was a little bit worried because I didn't know if that meant Simon Gain wasn't going to be on it anymore, but he is, and his art's amazing. Prophet issue 31 by Brandon Graham. Giannis, Milano Giannis, and And that's it, really. Has a great cover with Boo Cook. There are loads of other people on it, but I couldn't decide who of the other people to mention. That also continues Marvelous. It's an ongoing story now, so there is a trade paperback out of the first few issues of this run, though, and it is well worth buying.
Just in time for Christmas.
Yes, yes. I have noted the increase in cover price, but I was having a conversation with our friend James at the... at our local comic shop, and we kind of decided that maybe in this particular case, because a lot of the Image books are staying at $2.99, in this particular case it's more likely that it's, you know, it's basically either this book is $3.99 or it doesn't come out. It's an awkward economic compromise that I don't think always makes sense, but you know, if it means I get to keep reading it, then I don't mind. I'll also very briefly mention 2000 AD. 1811. It is ABC Warriors, and it's a weird time to suggest that people pick it up, because ABC Warriors and the wonderful Brass Sun actually finish their stories finish in this issue, and I think there's still another couple of issues to go. It's more of a jumping off point, if you were of a mind to do it, than a jumping on point. I don't know what's going to happen in the next issue. My guess is that the wonderful mega city, there's a lovely Disraeli cover
on
the back,
but that's a wraparound. Yeah, I was going to say, I was trying to have a look at it. It's amazing.
The Cold Deck stories continue to dovetail really nicely with each other. The Judge Dredd, Judge Dredd, written by Al Ewing with art by Henry Flint. The Cy Spurrier and... got to try and remember the names, flicking back and forwards. The Cy Spurrier and Simon Colby, Simping Detective. And the Low Life by Rob Williams and Disraeli stories are all dovetailing really nicely. I wonder if... I think it actually says in this issue... Yes, it says in the very back that issue Prog 1812 is going to be the end of this story. I suspect that's
an overture.
1812 over. Oh my goodness!
Oh, that's quick. That was Andrew.
That was really good. I wonder if that's deliberate though.
Maybe.
Maybe the next issue is going to be pretty epic. I mean, that'll make it a really interesting issue if literally. It is all these three stories, and it's the whole comic size. I don't know if this is the case. I don't know if that's what they're doing. I don't know if this is actually the case. But that would be the first time that an issue of 2000 AD was literally just for the people who are already reading 2000 AD. Because there'll be no reason to pick it up unless you've already been picking up the previous issue.
If it helps, I'll buy two copies.
Yeah, awesome. It has been amazing. It has been really, really amazing. I actually also got my copy of The Simping Detective, the first trade, by Simon Spurrier and Fraser Irving. I just want to mention, I've only read the first couple of stories. It's still pretty good. It's really good noir. Mega City noir stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like Simon Colby's art on this, but Fraser Irving's art on the first book is just amazing. Absolutely incredible work. Really, really good. I do like Fraser Irving anyway, but it's like better than I've seen his work before.
If Twitter's to be believed, I know Rob Williams and Chris Weston and many of the other creators that are working on, they're to be believed. There's even bigger things coming.
Oh my goodness, but I can't touch that.
As they say, apparently they were saying what's planned for post this event is even more exciting.
I can't cope with that. We just had a day of chaos, and now this, and I don't understand. Uncanny Avengers number 2. I got this as well. This is $3.99. It's written by Rick Remender with art by John Cassaday and colours by Laura Martin. It's a continuation of the story from the first issue. It's really good and creepy. Continuing with the weird political situation that A versus X left the Marvel Universe in, with mutants suddenly hated and feared again, because there are loads of them again. The first issue set up a mutant terrorist, which, you know, seriously messed things up as if they weren't already messed up with a mutant Phoenix person having destroyed... Well, basically, they made a mess, didn't they, in A versus X?
They made a right mess. Doesn't the Red Skull look happy on the front cover, though?
Yeah, there are some amazing moments. My favourite moments in this issue were all Rogue. They were all the bits with Rogue in. I thought she was awesome in this. There was some really interesting use of her powers. She's become very good with them. There were... there was a really emotional flashback moment that tells you, that reminds you. I don't know if it was actually a repeat of an actual scene that happened, or if it's just an extrapolation of a scene that probably would have happened when she first got introduced. I do remember that when she got introduced to the X-Men, she was a villain, and most of the X-Men weren't happy about it. But there's a scene in this that tells you why she's so upset that Professor X died at the end of A versus X. And there's a really, really nice moment with Havok, who's still a bit of a non-character at this point, but there's a really nice moment with him and a civilian. But I'm going to keep reading it because I'm enjoying it, but the Red Skull is not, although this take on him is quite interesting and has had a whole bunch of continuity, a whole bunch of decades worth of continuity stripped from him. I don't really like the Red Skull as a villain.
So it's kind of, I freaking love the Red Skull.
He's kind of an indicator of all the things you're supposed to love that are crazy about comics. And, you know, I read all of those black and white Jack Kirby, British reprints of Jack Kirby stuff and Steve Ditko stuff and people like that when I was a kid. But I'm not as tied to it nostalgically or aesthetically as so many people are. So he kind of, when all of this other human or emotional stuff is going on in the story, he kind of sticks out like a big red skull.
I prefer him when he does what he should do, and he's a Captain America villain. So I like him when he's in Captain America.
When he was he seems like a bit of a throwback because he made a lot of sense when Captain America was fighting Nazis.
Mm.
And he even sort of made sense when America was very paranoid about the Cold War. Area. Yeah, yeah, and then the Cold War and stuff like that. But he's kind of... although he wasn't actually... that's kind of a bit spurious because he wasn't actually a symbol for...
he is red, though.
He is red, but I don't think he was ever a symbol for communism. Or maybe he was, I don't know. Very briefly want to mention as well, because that wasn't very brief, that mention I just made. Cy Spurrier and Tan Engquart's second issue of X-Men Legacy. I liked the first issue a lot. I really, really liked the second issue. Now that things are moving, the first one was kind of a statement of intent and was pretty good. Well, no, it was really good, actually. But this one, things are really starting to kick off. There's a villain of peculiar intent introduced who has a power that I really like. He's it's kind of really fits in with the way I think, so he's really good. I won't say what he's like, though, because it's kind of a big part of the story is working out what's going on with him. But also there's a team of X-Men coming after David Haller or Legion, because basically, when he finds out that his father, Charles Xavier, died, he's gone a bit mental. And he has, he's one of the most powerful mutants ever. But he's basically got an almost limitless amount of personalities, okay. Each of them containing a particular power. And throughout his life in comics, he's always had trouble keeping them all under control. In the first issue, he loses complete control of them. In this issue, though, one thing that I don't think I've seen happen with David Haller before at the beginning of the story, it normally happens at the end of a story, is the first issue looked like it was setting him up to be as out of control as he always has been. In this issue, what we got to see was David Haller having agency of his own, which hasn't really, I don't think has really happened before. Except at the climax of the story, so it should be really interesting. I'm kind of a bit. I kind of love the idea of what's it called? Dissociative identity disorder. Anyway, split personality.
Okay.
Split personalities. I find it fascinating. So, I am still having a bit of trouble with Tan Eng Huat's art. I think I liked it a lot more in this issue, but it's he's perfect at the style he does, but it isn't necessarily a style that I'm in love with. It's kind of very cartoony in a way that doesn't always resonate with me, but there are some lovely panels. There are some real standout panels in here, so it's good. I like the way he draws Chamber, who's just turned up in this issue as well. Finally, I just want to talk about Witch Doctor, Malpractice, first issue of a new series of Witch Doctor by Brandon Seifert and Lucas Kettner and Andy Troy, coming from Image. And it's $2.99. I got a variant cover that is gorgeous, but I think both covers are lovely. Witch Doctor is a series that I talked about a little bit last year. I can't remember if either of you have been reading it. No. But it's
I know John did. John did a spotlight on
it. I think he might have done, yeah. It's basically about a guy who's kind of like House MD, in that he's a bit of a prick. And he's a bit of a maladjusted character, but he's also a diagnostician and doctor, but of the occult. And it's got this really interesting take on the supernatural world, in that it kind of tries to come up with an organic, almost natural biological reason for why vampires work the way they were, what a demonic infestation is. This is the first part of a new run. I don't know how long it's going to go for. The first volume was it's six issues apparently. The first volume was mostly one shots, like was mostly one off stories, yeah. Contained cases.
Yeah.
And there was an overarching theme, and I think the last two issues were kind of tied together, but the first few were all a different supernatural thing and this world's version of them, whereas this is setting up to be more of a continuous run. The good doctor himself, Vincent Morrow, is still just wacky, and it's quite difficult to know what's going on in his head, but he's being messed around with by forces beyond his control. The supporting cast are brought much more to the fore in this issue. There's the character that we're introduced to in the first series, who he gets in as his paramedic, who's like more of a traditionally medically trained medic, whose name escapes me, but we get to find out that he's suffering a little bit from post-traumatic stress disorder, I believe, which is quite interesting. And then the very crazy character, Penny, who we don't really know an awful lot about, she's basically his enforcer. She's kind of pretty demonic and messed up herself. That's her on the cover, by the way, with the funky face. When things get difficult and physical, as they sometimes do when you're dealing with supernatural entities, she basically keeps him safe. But we find out, it feels like we found out, we saw more into her world in this issue than we did in the whole of the last run. So it's pretty cool. The art, the writing by Brandon Seifert is pretty good, although I really like the self-contained stories. But the art by Lucas Kettner is just amazing. And the colour art by Andy Troy really makes it look, it works perfectly in sync with his quite heavy black lines, and it's and quite heavy inking. It kind of looks like a bit like Bernie Wrightson, and it's just, but the colours work so well with it that it almost looks painted. It's just lovely. Really, really good comic. Well worth going out and getting this first issue of the new series, Malpractice, Witch Doctor Malpractice.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, guys. What about you, Jane? What did you read this week?
This week I picked up issue one of Nowhere Men, which is written by Eric Stevenson with art by, is it Nate Belgrade or Belgard?
I think it's Belgard.
Is it Belgard? Yeah. Nate Bugard, Geordie Bella, and Phonographics did the lettering. It's a story about four scientists who specialise in very different, unique areas. And it starts off with them in the 70s, youngsters, 60s, 70s youngsters. They're literally on the verge of their breakthroughs. They've developed a company and things are going very well for them. It has a really great way of introducing the characters. It's kind of like it's almost like a medical journal, a science journal, where it has like the Science Chronicle, yeah. So it's like a newspaper, and it has sort of info sheet on each member of the team and what they do, what their specialities are. So it's like an interview info sheet. That it fast forwards to when they're much older, their company's established. They're not getting on as well as they used to.
Oh, we can emphasise that.
I'm fine, I don't know what you're doing there.
Whatever.
This book feels like the brilliance has outwitted them, and they're all in quarrels or messes or problems that they sort of brought on themselves, but only they. It feels a bit like where the book might go is that they have to come together to solve some issues. It's brilliant. It's a really good story, but it's sci-fi, kind of lots of mystery, lots of intrigue. There are bits of it that feel a bit disjointed, but they still work together. So as the story develops on this issue, there's a part of it where you're completely taken out of the surroundings and the discussions that happened before, and something completely different is happening, but it doesn't jar. It did transition quite well. It was really well done. The art's amazing in this. It's clean. It reminds me of Red Wing.
Mm-hmm.
Just the panels are very clear, but the art's really detailed, so you know exactly what's going on. It's got a really nice white border around it all as well, which breaks up what's happening quite nicely as well. It's good stuff.
I like that sort of thing. A lot of comics have. We talked about it before, the art popping out all over the place and it becomes quite difficult to read. I saw that. It does look pretty gorgeous.
Yeah, it is. The cover's really nice as well. It's white background and it's got real pops of really bright colours. Also, once reading the book, you realise the symbolisation of the covers as well between the design for the team. I really like the fact that all the information is in the back. So
it's a really nicely designed book, isn't it?
It is. It's really beautifully designed. There's two really very spectacular, three very spectacular splash pages in it, which are really good. One of them made me really think of Alien. It's like their logo, and it's the introduction to the story where it's just literally got the title, and it's got like a logo and things.
It's
like a
corporate logo.
Yeah, it's really, really good. It's so
in the centre pages.
Yeah.
When you say it reminds you a bit of Red Wing, you mean that because it's the storytelling. Look, the storytelling in the art looks really similar, but the style is much more, because Red Wing's quite, the lines are quite scratchy, aren't they? But that looks really crisp.
Yeah, but it's still, this is still really detailed. It's not as scratchy as, scratchy at all. It's very defined, but there's a lot of detail going on, but it's very clean. And with Red Wing, there's one panel that completely stuck out where you see a body basically biodegrading.
It's like being segmented. It's like it's not disintegrating, but it's falling apart.
Yeah, falling apart as you go. And it was immensely detailed, but it was just so clean. Everything was very clear on it, which was great. Really, really good first issue. And the design of the book itself is really well done.
I like the look of it. I should have picked this up.
The colour's amazing as well. I know you mentioned Geordie Bella because you spoke to her at Thought Bubble.
She's brilliant.
The colour in that's incredible. Mm. It's really well done. It's just, it's really good.
I like it.
I think Jane did too. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. That's it. You can't help but flip through and go, oh, that's nice. Mm. Nice.
Well, I get the feeling I just ruined a big bit of surprise
that was
for myself.
But that's fine. The story's worth it. That was really good. Should still be. There's quite a few issues left in our local comic book stores, so you should check it out.
if you live in Southampton.
Yeah, if you live in Southampton.
Alternatively, go to a different comic book store that might also have it.
Yeah.
Or Comixology.
Yes, or Comixology.
Or just go around somewhere else so you know as it and steal it.
Don't steal things.
Yeah. You're such a tealy.
Everyone's got a different like moral like landscape, haven't they?
That's true.
Yes, the second book I'm going to talk about is, I know, American Vampire again. Oh,
you very never talk about that.
You very rarely talk about that. Is that something you just started reading?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's by an up-and-coming writer.
Called Your Boyfriend, Scott Snyder.
To clarify with listeners who might be confused, James and I haven't just suffered massive memory loss. We are being ironical.
Yeah.
In the Chronicle.
Aye.
Yes, American Vampire issue 33 by Scott Snyder and art by Rafael Albuquerque.
Hot dog!
From Vertigo at $2.99.
Good price point.
This is the last issue in the story The Blacklist, which has seen Pearl and Skinner Sweet in some compromising positions and some sticky situations and some life-threatening scenarios.
They've been having violent sex, because that's what it sounds like to me.
Sounds like my favourite party ever.
Pearl has been working with the VMS, as Skinner Sweet has, because Skinner Sweet has had an implant.
Who are the VMS?
The vampire... Oh, no.
Are they vampire hunters?
Yes, they're vampire hunters. Sorry, I can't remember what it stands for.
That's all right.
No one's used to know. The VMS. Pearl and Skinner Sweet have been working with them. Skinner Sweet's had an implant in him. He's kind of working under duress.
Oh.
Yeah. Like they are hunting a unique, very violent breed of vampires who, from a personal perspective, had put Pearl's husband Henry into a coma. And basically, there's a revenge element to the whole story. Yeah. It's been about Pearl's turmoil with Henry aging, because Henry's...
Where are we in history at the moment?
Oh, I think we're in the 50s still.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's in the 50s. Henry is human, and Pearl vowed that he would never return. Henry's obviously aged and Pearl hasn't, and the attack has left him in a coma. He's quite old, so he's very much fighting for his life. So Pearl's got the turmoil of not contemplating her own mortality, but his mortality and what life's going to be like without him and her, you know, her everlasting life that's always going to go on and on and on.
It's like Highlander.
Only there can be more than one of us.
I know, that's true.
And in the midst of all this, Pearl's seeking revenge. She's very, everything's compounded at the moment. And this last issue was brilliant. It was an amazing ending to the story, and it wrapped some things up for some characters. But my God, it was heartbreaking.
Did it make you jerk some tears?
I didn't cry, but I felt very sad in my heart.
Is it because you can't cry?
No, I can cry. No.
Oh, okay.
Would you like to?
No, I can't cry in demand.
It's been ages since we had someone cry on the podcast.
It has. Would you like to cry for the listeners?
I can't. I'm not performing.
Now James is crying.
The underwater world. that was crazy.
Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away.
It's the last issue before a long hiatus, isn't it?
Yeah, there's going to be one more issue.
All right.
And then there's going to be a hiatus. Obviously, they're both... I don't know Rafael Albuquerque.
Hot dog.
But Scott Snyder's certainly got a lot on his plate at the moment, and he's doing such a good job. Doing such a good job with everything else he's working at the moment. I can understand why he wanted to take a break from this.
The counterpoint to Jane always saying, and you quite often actually, James, always saying nice things about Scott Snyder, is that James just called him a fat bastard.
You're welcome. Put that on the cover.
I did hear someone saying the other day, because we've talked about how long it's going to be, when we were talking about Hellblazer, we talked about how long it's going to be. This is the halfway point approximately, is that right?
The
first half. I think someone said it's a fitting... it's going to be, it's a fitting climax to the first half of the saga.
Okay.
That doesn't necessarily mean that we've had exactly as many issues and we're going to have the same amount again, but it just gives a sense of where we are in the American vampire story.
I was thinking that could, I didn't know anything about that, I don't know how that's going to happen, but from where it started in like 1900 to 1950s, I guess that's almost 100 points of today. So from that point, I don't know how long it's going to go on for.
I hope it ends with them killing some borderline paedophile sparkly vampires.
Your voice cracked a little bit when you said that.
Well, it makes me angry. Don't know how they get away with it, especially in light of, you know, all that's going on at the moment.
Okay, so not a great jumping on point because it is a nice issue. Gonna be great in trend, and Christmas is coming up.
Do you know, I was just thinking I need to add, because I was reading it for what I do actually need to pick up the American Vampire trades. Because
I really like the first couple of issues, and I need to pick up more.
You should do that.
Yeah, well, maybe I will.
Well, maybe.
You're not the boss of me.
Want you to.
Maybe if a Vertigo doing a decent job of collecting them, do we know?
Wasn't that? They Might Be Giants.
What?
You're not
the boss of me. Was They Might Be Giants. Well done, James.
Look starring, at the big brain on James.
From Malcolm in the Middle, starring Breaking Bad Man. It's all connected. James was talking about Breaking Bad earlier on. It's all connected. It's like The Wire.
And we all nick Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon.
Thank you, James.
Okay, thank you, Jane.
Kee-ha! What is it good for?
Talking about comics.
Hello, monkeys. Kee-ha here, the mighty potato. I come to talk to you about Bayou Arcana. This is a anthology volume, individual chapters with different female artists and male writers, dealing with a place deep down south where dreams come true and nightmares find flesh. A place where the oppressed discover freedom and the oppressor violent retribution, to quote from the back. This is a mosaic project. I think Jimmy Pearson, who has the foreword and first story and stuff, was the instigator of it, but different people have explored the world through their art and their narratives in different ways. As such, I'm going to give each component part its own crack of the whip. Suffice to say, the initial frame story, The Tale of Old Mercy, by Jimmy Pearson, and art by Valia Capaldi, neither of which I was familiar with before, though I understand Valia Capaldi has done work with Insomniacs and UK, etc. in the past. It's a very tight little story that basically sets up how an African-American community ended up in this sort of swamp, dreamland-type space. With lovely art that sort of evokes old-school storybooks, a kind of watercolour-y, my uneducated eye, a fine sort of 19th century penmanship and graininess. It worked pretty well, if I say so myself. And it sets up the story quite well. I did have a little bit concerned that this collection is going to be mainly predominantly white, predominantly European people talking about African American dilemmas. I think the element of Dreamland takes it away from that. I might explore that when I review other stories later on. But anyway, that's a pre-say what Bayou Arcana is, and a very brief review of that storybook texture, the first story, The Tale of Old Mercy, to come back in subsequent ones, and review the other combined stories in the anthology. I do love mosaic novels and stuff. I tried one myself at cutthroatcreeks.wordpress.com. I've left it on the internet in case anybody wants to do anything with it. So I'm predisposed towards this as a narrative experience, if nothing else. So that's Kiha from Dissecting World, the podcast that rips the beating heart out of science fiction and fantasy universes and gives them a nice healthy lick. Signing off.
Okay, so has anything happened in comics this week?
I was on Twitter, and you'll love this.
No, James.
Rob Liefeld didn't say anything.
I don't care what colour his socks are or how he's gelled his hair.
But I swear to God, I thought he said he was giving up on comics, and I'm sure he was promoting the comic.
No, enough.
Okay.
I don't think we need to talk very much about anything. Just to summarise, Grant Morrison and Alan Moore don't like each other. The small press scene in the UK doesn't like itself.
No.
And women don't like James Gunn. And I think that's about it, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all a bit too depressing.
If you had to choose a side, whose side would you be on, Nick?
I'd choose the side of comics.
Jane?
Grant Morrison.
And I'd choose Warren Ellis. So, there we go.
Let's put this nastiness aside, shall we?
Hey, monkeys, it's Max at last minute with a fastish talking contribution that probably has some relation to tits. See, I've been reading a new manga series called Rookie Policewoman Kiriko-san. Don't worry, not going to talk about it. I have a pod specifically for such things, which has been around 2 weeks now and has generated more huge-breasted fan art on popular Japanese image board Pixiv than just about anything ever. It's kind of crotch-warming to see that perverts can so readily attach themselves to a cute big-boob heroine in a series running in a magazine targeted at teens. It's like they're preparing a particularly icky, spunk-filled torch to pass down to the next generation of masturbators who are just getting to that awkward part of their life when fapping and dipping are going to dominate their every waking moment, when they sit there uncomfortable around the objects of their affection, wondering how much of a faux pas it is to feverishly whack or plunge off in public in the faces of their loved ones, yelling, love me, over and over and over, and I wonder why we don't really see this side of fan art in Western comics. I mean, I'm not really that fussed, but would it help hormone-riddled youth as Judge Dredd was frequently depicted ramming away at Hershey? Or if other comics reference? It's all out there, but we don't really have websites dedicated to it in the same way Pixiv seems to present a plethora of softcore nonsense. We have Tumblr, I guess, but that's mostly full of yaoi images of Iron Man and Captain America, and if yaoi can be blamed for one thing, it's the blooming of social awkwardness in young women who don't understand that control issues and voyeurism aren't necessarily attractive qualities. I guess what I'm saying is, I really want there to be more porn of Gambit, currently starring in his own series by James Asmus, and as of issue 6, Diogenes Nevers. I'm not even editing that. It's a James Bond-esque romp with a side of thievery as Gambit is forced to go to Britain to steal something valuable for a fat, dumpy criminal. The plot's not important. What is important is Gambit being a suave mother-lover, charming the Queen, as a sex machine like Gambit surely must, and generally being debonair and charming and, oh wait, he fights with Pete Wisdom, shipping ahoy, next. Okay then, X-Men Legacy. It's about a superpowered schizophrenic, and it also has Chamber in it with his whole face blown off thing, and I guess neither of those two sound particularly sexy, but Legion does tend not to wear a top, so I guess you could... I don't know. What about FF? It has She-Hulk for the muscle fetishists. Medusa? For those icky hair fetishists, and Scott Lang in emotional distress at the still fresh wound in his heart from the death of his daughter, which is super sexy. No? One more try. Okay, there's The Flash, which I haven't read, but last issue had a monkey rip off the trickster's arm, and someone was whacking off to that, right? Probably with the dismembered arm. Monkeys are like that? I don't know. Maybe Western comics just can't do sexy. Oh wait, I talked about multiple warheads last time I did one of these, and oh hey, that's not only sexy, it has a girl called Sex Criminal, and the second issue is out, and go buy that, you scumbags. And don't get the pages stuck together. I promise next time I'll come up with something a bit less awful, maybe. For now, I have outfilled the monkeys, and that's an achievement in itself. Next week, the aristocrats.
It's story time!
Yeah.
Let me take you back to a small two-bedroom semi-detached house on a council estate somewhere on the periphery of Winchester in Hampshire. And there's a young boy with a red generic, probably a Sanyo generic Walkman-type device in his bedroom listening to the Def Leppard album Hysteria.
He sounds like a twat.
And whenever whenever I read, he was and remains a massive fucking tool. Whenever I read Asterix and the Chieftain's Shield, I am taken back to that young man. For some reason, whenever I read this book, I cannot get that image out of my mind of me listening to Hysteria.
Isn't it funny? The second you mentioned it, I suddenly remembered the whole of a song from it just popped into my head.
Any move.
No, now that one has as well. I was specifically thinking, hysteria, get hysterical when you get that feeling.
Saturday
and
start believing. Rock it. Yeah.
I was thinking that your spotlights need a theme tune, but that really wasn't what I was going for.
So during this spotlight, if you want to quickly now pause this, go and download Def Leppard's Hysteria.
I'd be really surprised if most of the people listening don't already have it somewhere.
I haven't. I've got it on tape in my shed.
Oh, yeah. Maybe not in format they can really listen to.
What do you need to do? Go quickly download it.
Put the tape in your shed.
Quickly go to my shed. Get a cassette player.
Any more unattainable.
It's quite attainable to me. I can get to my shed.
Do you have a tape player still?
No.
Oh.
I tell you what I did see, actually, on the way into work today. I went past a place called the Beatnik Emporium in town, and they had this really quite funky old Fisher-Price cassette player, which I'm really tempted to go and buy. I'm deep down, I'm a big fat hipster.
I need to get a tape player that I can plug into my computer, because I've got some old Armando Iannucci radio shows and stuff. I've got a few things on tape that I just can't get any other way.
If you buy one of those, let me know, because I want to borrow it off you so I don't have to buy one.
So that you don't have to go and find a download copy of Def Leppard's Hysteria.
Rock it!
Yes! Satellite of love! They really
sticky sweet.
They really rocked out. The story of Def Leppard is a sad one, but full of joy, joyous, energetic music. I love them. Anyway, James, what was that boy doing while listening to Def Leppard?
Once he finished masturbating, he was...
to Def Leppard.
Yeah, absolutely. Joey What's-His-Face was quite good looking, wasn't he? To be fair, he wasn't quite as androgynous as Sebastian Bach. I once spent a very frustrating afternoon trying to find his boobies in a poster that was in Kerrang, and one half of the poster had stuff in the middle between the poster, and the first half had Sebastian Bach's face, and then I was like flicking for it, and he clearly didn't have a top on. I couldn't work out why this was clearly this lady who didn't have a top on. Where was her? But it was Sebastian Bach all along. Sebastian Bach, he didn't have no boobies.
Sometimes I hate everything about you.
That was, who was that?
Ugly
now?
Kid Joe.
Ugly Kid Joe, that's it, yeah.
But you still haven't said what that boy was doing.
He was after he
finished masturbating. And then ruminated on the state of rock and roll.
Had a little cry. He read Asterix and the Chieftain's Shield.
Asterix the Chieftain's Shield.
Asterix and the Chieftain's Shield. Which is one of his favourite Asterix books to remain so to this day.
Buckle up, listener. It's going to be a wild one.
We start with a scene that we visited before in Asterix, and that's Caesar's victory over Vercingetorix at Alesia, who it seems no one is really sure where that exists. It's a running joke throughout the story, but none of us really know where Alesia is, where the Gauls were defeated. And until very recently, scientist boffins didn't know where Alesia was, but I believe they do now.
Julius Caesar. Because the thing I always forget, I always like get confused about is Caesar was like James Bond. It's a name that people have. It's no 007. It's like a name that... There were loads of them, weren't there? When there were loads of Caesars.
Once the dictators started, because there was Gaius Julius Caesar, and then there's Augustus Caesar, wasn't there, and a load of them, really.
It's a bit like my family with Georges.
Yeah. Caesar, first of all, he was known as Mr. Dog. But then he changed his name to Caesar, didn't he? Because before he defeated the Gauls, he was called Mr. Dog. And then he thought, oh, well, that's not really commensurate, really, with, you know, someone who's defeated all of Gaul.
No.
I need something a bit more status. I'll call myself Caesar.
I need something that will strike fear and thingy into citizens who are a superstitious and cowardly lot.
Yeah, I'm going to make them shit delicious meaty chunks in gravy.
You've got your piece of paper from Wikipedia out. It's a bit later in the day than you normally do.
It's almost like I forgot, but I didn't. So this book that's framed by us having a flashback to Alicia at Caesar's triumph over Vercingetorix, where we see a young legionary sneak off with the shield of Vercingetorix, was first published in Pilot magazine between issues 399 and 421 in 1967, then collected together and published in Fwench in 1968.
Is that how you say that word?
Fwench.
Fwench.
I've been watching the footballer Joey Barton a lot this week. Oh. I believe in a press conference where he spoke in English. He's been playing for Marseille on loan because he's a naughty boy. And that's where English footballers go to be punished now.
Oh,
to France. But it was first published in English in 1977. Preceded by Asterix Legion and followed by Asterix Olympic Games. You can read along with Wikipedia, should you choose. So we see this opening scene with the legionary. So Jane's got a look on her face like, she's like, oh shit, this is going to be a long one tonight. Yeah. I want to go home, I'm hungry. Yeah, I know, I can tell, I'm really sorry.
That's alright.
I've got some throat sweets in my bag, if that helps.
How is that going to, can I have one?
They're downstairs. Oh, you can before we go there. And basically on this first page we see this young legionary pick up the shield, lose it in a card game, another legionary loses it to a centurion, and eventually centurion uses it as payment in an inn, and we see in a very tiny panel a Gaulish warrior giving it as a souvenir of the defeat. Cut to the Gaulish village. The Gaulish village that we know so well. And Chief Vital Statistics is in some discomfort. All of these banquets that they enjoy has caught up with him. And he has got a liver malady.
Oh no.
How
serious is it?
Well, it's serious enough that Getafix...
Yeah,
he's on dialysis, that's right. And the story really centres around them selecting and purchasing a dialysis machine from Osama bin Laden. who at this time is still at large. Getafix diagnoses him with a liver ailment and suggests that he goes to take the waters in Vichy.
Okay.
Yeah. There's... One of my favourite, I remember so vividly, every time I read it, and to be fair, when I reread it, laughing out loud, which is a lovely scene, where Getafix, Asterix, and Pedimenta, Vital Statistics' wife, and Obelix, are all around his bed, discussing his ill health. And they each seem to take it in turns to poke him in the liver, culminating in Dogmatics bouncing into Obelix's arms via said liver, which is hilarious. Dear. Anyway, he's persuaded to go to Vichy, and Asterix and Obelix are charged with accompanying him. So off he goes, making sure that he eats as much food and drink as he possibly can, actually drinks the drink rather than eating it, as he can, until eventually, just before they get to Vichy, even a leaf falling on his stomach sends him into fits of pain. So Asterix and Obelix are acting as his guards in Vichy in the health spa, but eventually are asked to leave because obviously they're not patients. They're eating normally, so Obelix is eating numerous wild boar and so forth, and sending the patients who are there, we're only really allowed to eat boiled vegetables, sending them half nuts. So Asterix and Obelix are told to get lost, and Chief Vital Statistics suggests that because they're close, they take a trip to Gogovia, which is the scene of the Gauls' greatest victory against the Romans. So Asterix and Obelix agree and take in some of the local scenery. At this point, we're on page 13. I just want to sort of pause. one of my favourite panels in any Asterix book appears on this page. And it's just a scene of the two of them walking together. But it's just a perfect example of how wonderful an artist
Alberto Edizay
was. Oh, that's embarrassing, isn't it? It's such a simple little panel, but there's so much movement and life in just this two-shot of them walking together, Asterix stretching to enjoy the morning air, and Obelix plodding along. It's just
kind of got a nice roll to him, hasn't he? Obelisk.
He really just was such a skilled, talented, remains to be a skilled, talented artist.
Quick sidebar.
Yes.
I find it interesting that the character Asterix is called Asterix, and he's very famous, which you'd think would make the word Asterix quite a well-known word.
Yeah.
But most people call Asterixes stars.
Yeah.
When they do like a footnote.
Which is strange because Asterix is a star.
Yes. But I've always found that strange. Most people don't know what the right name for an asterisk as punctuation point
is. I have to differentiate them by calling an asterisk an asterisk.
Asterisk.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's where his name comes from, though, isn't it? Anyway, carry on. What I'll do is I'll put a little asterisk in the show.
Yeah.
I'll shunt what I just said to the bottom with a little asterisk attached to it.
That's a handy little footnote. They bump into a Roman convoy with an agent, special envoy of Julius Caesar, whose boxcar is being carried by not at all racially insensitive characters. He is called...
That's awful, isn't it?
It is awful, yeah. Oh, Noxious Vapors.
But everyone's such a ridiculous crook now. It's just... Anyway, carry on.
We spoke about this before. They are horrible caricatures of African people, very black, massive, big red lips. Everyone does have a ridiculous caricature in Asterix, but even so, it still feels slightly uncomfortable now.
Mm.
So they attack Noxious Vapors, who is quite a noted character in the Gregovian area. Once he's slapped by Obelix, he falls at the feet of a local called Wine and Spirits.
He's got a name that sounds like something.
Yes, and apparently the entire local economy of Gregovia is made up of people who own wine and charcoal emporiums. And apparently they mention this to Wine and Spirits, and he said, "Well, yeah, but we buy each other's wine and charcoal, so we keep the economy going that way."
Little internal economy.
And it seems he and most of his counterparts are actually veterans of Alesia. And so they integrate themselves in the local community and look forward to enjoying a nice holiday there. And there's lots of enjoyable punning and wordplay, which is great fun. Meanwhile, though, Noxious Vapors, a bit pissed off, returns to Rome and talks to Caesar. And Caesar suggests that these Gauls need to be taught a lesson or two, and they should be reminded who the bosses are. So Caesar says, I want to triumph. I want to parade into Gorgovia, remind them, you know, this is the scene of their greatest triumph, and I'm going to rub their noses in it because I rule this land now. You're going to find me Vercingetorix's shield. You're going to carry me in to Gorgovia on his shield. So Noxious Vapor goes to look at all of Julius Caesar's spoils, and he can't find it. Thus begins...
A quest.
To find the chieftain's shield. Yeah. Now, he gets back to Gorgovia, and he sends a deadbeat legionary off to try and find out, because he thinks the locals will know where it is. Sends this deadbeat off to find out where it is. After an initial search in the charcoal, which throughout this book we see the Roman soldiers going searching for the charcoal and coming out very dirty. Charcoal makes them very dirty a bit.
It's funny, I like it.
And there's some nice wordplay there about dirty looks after the gunshot. But he sends this legionary to go and spy on them. Unfortunately, he's a terrible dipsomaniac.
What's that?
Drunken.
Oh.
And he ends up giving the game away. So Asterix is like, well, not letting Caesar get away with that. He wants the shield. Well, I tell you what, my two tentists, I'm going to find the shield, and we will parade into Gorgovia on the shield. So they both get on the trail. First of all, they are sent to... So this is where the first page of the book becomes significant. They go after that first legionary founder, who now lives in Clermont-Ferrand, which I only found out by reading Wikipedia. He's a wheel manufacturer. Clermont-Ferrand is where Michelin have their headquarters.
Ah.
And we go to Circumbendy Bus's Wheels, who's the chap they're after. And in the centre of that village is a statue of Julius Caesar. Now, apparently, in Clermont-Ferrand in France, the real actual place, there is a statue of Vercingetorix.
Oh.
So in the place that Julius Caesar's statue appears in this book is where Vercingetorix's statue appears in the real world.
That's weird.
Fascinating fact. He has some racially insensitive intercom runners.
Oh.
Yeah. The intercom basically is a horn on a desk. The person, you say what you want to convey to the other person, and a small black person, basically, with extremely large dreadlocks, runs to the destination where the message needs to be delivered. It's funny if it wasn't so racially intensive. Anyway, it turns out...
So it's not funny, then?
Well, it depends. If you're a racist, it's hilarious. To be fair, the, 11-year-old me did find it very, very funny.
Look, maybe we should just pretend they're like dinosaurs, and then it's like the Flintstones.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's true. And to be fair, back in Asterix's day, racism was sort of quite doable, wasn't it?
Even more than in Tintin's day.
Yeah, totally.
It was even longer ago than that.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Anyway.
So we find out that actually he lost the shield in a card game, so they set off to try and find the next character who they are told is a attendant in a spa.
Mm-hmm.
So Asterix and Obelix check in at the spa. Obviously, Obelix doesn't particularly enjoy the health spa treatment where he's only eating sort of boiled vegetables and having various treatments, only to find out that a few months ago this character left to open up a restaurant of his own called The Boring Wine.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine how displeased Asterix and Obelix is, and there's a lovely little scene where they're in a huff with each other and they're walking along with them. Before long, they realise that actually they love each other very much.
Mm.
He's nice. He's a nice little character scene between them.
They give each other a little hug.
Friends.
Ancient Gaulish friends. So, they bump into the Romans at the Boring Wine, who are one step ahead of them, which allows them to have a nice carve-up, and find out once again that this character didn't have the shield. He ended up losing it to the drunk centurion.
Hmm.
Who he's unsure of the whereabouts of. The Romans, however, are on the same trail, and they do find the centurion, who reveals that actually he gave the shield to a owner of a wine and charcoal emporium called Wine and Spirits. So there's a lovely little scene where they go to Noxious Vapors chamber, because at this point Wine and Spirits has gone missing. They think that the governor has nicked him, so they go demanding to see Wine and Spirits, and everyone shouts his name because they want to get hold of him, so they want the shield.
Mm-hmm. But they're all shouting, "We want Wine and Spirits."
They're all shouting, "We want Wine and Spirits," and it's very funny. We find out once Wine and Spirits turns out that he didn't get captured at all. He ran away because he was ashamed, because he knew they were looking for the shield, and he felt like he could let everyone down, really, because he gave it away to some guy he had no hope of ever finding, until a slim and healthy Vital Statistics walks through the door, and he shouts, "That's him!"
Mm-hmm.
Vital Statistics, having lost all the weight, now looks like this young Gaulish warrior. It turns out all the time that the shield they were looking for is the one that Vital Statistics is carrying about on in all of the books.
Through all of that's an almost Lindelofian moment of self-reference.
Without a shadow of a doubt. It's if this book was Excel, it would have a circular reference.
Hmm. I don't understand that.
Only it wouldn't be irritating and make me swear.
Ooh, spreadsheet-related humour.
Yeah, no, that's right.
I think that's what people tune in for.
So, ultimately, the
tune
one...
Tune in for.
Absolutely. Thanks for tuning in. More Excel humour next week. stand by for some VLOOKUP japes. So, eventually, Vercing Getorix, no, sorry, Vital Statistics, is paraded in front of Caesar on top of his shield. And Caesar's like, oh, fucking what? Oh, God, you let me down, Noxious Vapors. You're off to Africa. I'm leaving the two drunkards in charge.
Noxious Vapors got a funny name. It sounds like something.
Noxious Vapors got shit canned by Caesar.
Mm.
And so we're led back home, where, strangely enough, Cacophonics the Bard is allowed around the table, but Impedimenta bans... Vital Statistics, and we end with a shot of their house and him suggesting to her that she might not want to hit him on the head with the shield. Still,
the Chieftain shield.
That's right. Still one of my favourite books. It's a great mystery. It holds up really well, actually. The through plot of the story. It's funny, actually, reading it as a bit older. Some of the puns feel a bit long in the tooth, but it's still a lovely... lovely, beautifully plotted book. The only thing I had a criticism is I remember it being a really well-coloured and vivid book, but some of the printing in this, the transfer, there's a few pages that are really, really washed out. This one in particular,
that's a bit weird, yeah.
Like slightly blurred lines and really washed out printing, which is...
You found that in instant.
Yes, which is odd. But that's my only real criticism, is it's not transferred brilliantly into this most recent printing, which I have. It's wonderful. I love the Chieftain Shield, and I don't know if I love the fact that it's inspired me to go and listen to old Def Leppard albums.
Well, I won't anymore.
Boom, boom, boom. But as I've said before, we are into what I think is the golden period of Asterix books, where... for some time, they just produce just brilliant books. The next one being, and I'm glad I get to do it in this year, Asterix at the Olympic Games.
Ooh.
Which is culturally insensitive to Greeks. So I look forward to that one a great deal.
Huzzah!
I think I should just get it in before Christmas.
Greeks have it coming.
That's what she said.
Mm-hmm. It's also the first book where Obelix shows an interest in business. I just read it on the wiki.
And it's also the first book where Impedimenta, Chief Vice's wife, is named by name.
For ages and ages, in the late 90s and early noughties, I was writing about Southampton, but for some bizarre reason, I decided I was going to call it about living in a city.
Mm.
And I called the city Impedimenta, and it never occurred to me that I must have picked it up from her. I thought, well, that's an interesting sounding word that I've just entirely made up. But apparently not.
I definitely think, I'd almost finished the review and then decided I'm going to have just dip another toe back in the water. What the book really benefits from, that the earlier books can't possibly, is you have a really well-defined cast of characters as well, which it draws on really nicely. So, you know, you have to be really familiar with Chief Vital Statistics. I'm familiar with the fact that he gets carted about on a shield for the story to pay off at all.
Mm.
So, you know, it's probably not a book that you could read as your first Asterix book because it wouldn't make any sense, really.
Well, it certainly wouldn't have the same kicker.
It certainly wouldn't. I love it so much.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, Jane, awesome. And thank you, Nick, and thank you, listener.
Do either of you have any plans for the coming week?
Yeah, I'm going to kick off my Christmas movie-watching regime on Saturday. I think we're also putting our Christmas decorations up.
You've got a regime.
Yeah, we have to watch Christmas movies, at least one Christmas movie every weekend now, as well as ad hoc Christmas movies during the week, now until Christmas itself.
I'm struggling to think of it as Christmas because I haven't yet heard, in the wild, I haven't yet heard Fairy Tale of New York.
No, nor have I.
Or done any shopping at all.
Strangely, I've pretty much done all of my shopping.
Maybe I should look into that.
I should.
What about you, Jane?
I do, strangely enough, we'll be watching a Christmas film this weekend.
Are you coming over?
Yes.
Oh, cool. I didn't she hadn't confirmed that.
Oh, crap. I thought I said that. No, you didn't know. I can confirm.
Oh, this is an exciting moment that we're confirming arrangements live on the pod.
Oh, wow.
That's good. I like it.
But tomorrow, it's depending on how cold it is, it could be jam market beer and sausage, or going into cosy shopping centre for a Wagamama's or a Mondo's or something.
Nice. You're free to join us as well if you're free this Saturday and watch Christmas movies.
I think I'm going to be doing study stuff.
Well, certainly, but if you want to come over, you can.
And I'm listener, having to be a bad student.
If you want to come over this weekend, listener, just DM me at James Mond, and I'm sure we can make some sort of arrangement.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be doing student stuff this week.
Okay.
Mostly, I'm going to be a student. I'm not a very good student, which is interesting because I work in a place where we're forever telling people how to work with and motivate students, and I'm not a very motivated student, which is terrible, so I'm struggling a little bit. And I think that's it, really. I don't think I'm going to be doing much else. But I do like Wagamamas.
I do. Ooh.
I find it very strange that our one is in a shopping centre.
I know.
Though. I don't like that very much.
It closes really early. So
I'm not really. I don't think I'm ever going to eat there because I'm never going to eat in there because before 8 o'clock is not when I go to restaurants to eat.
I do not care for Wagamamas.
No, you don't, do you?
Okay. You've ruined things with your negativity, James.
I took my daughter to the to that level of the shopping centre on Sunday.
Was that the highest up she'd ever been?
Yeah. I stuffed a Happy Meal in her face because I'm a bad dad.
That's okay. Yeah, so I think it remains for us to thank each other. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Jane.
To thank our contributor.
Thank you,
contributor.
I think as a team, we want to thank David Wynn. He knows why.
Thank you, David. You're lovely, man.
Thank you, listener, for listening. You rock, listener. We like you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, be sure to listen to Unanswered. I have, and it made my ears smile.
Oh, my God, he's a convert. Remember when...
Oh, he was such a whinger about it last week. I will put it in the show notes. Thank you for mentioning that, James. That's very nice of you.
I think Life Partner Steve's the class act on it, but you know, just keep that between us.
Obviously.
Okay.
He's both the straight man and the funny man. I don't really know how that works. Okie dokie. Thank you, listener. You're awesome. You rock. And we shall speak to you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.